derivative of the momentum was produced in part by a random force term, eta of t. And then, because of the motion of the particle, there was a friction term, which was p over tau. We then solved this equation, looking at the effect of that random force using the relationship in which the average of the square of that force is a delta function at the different between the different times. And we concluded that this equation implied the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. Basically, because this random force produced a Gaussian distribution, and the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution is Gaussian in momentum. That was the first conclusion. The second conclusion had to do with calculating the probability that we would have some values x at time t based upon a dynamical system theory in which we had dx k dt is v of x, k, and t. We then concluded that d rho of x and t dt, the partial derivative of rho with respect to time, was produced by partial derivatives of rho with respect, partial derivatives of things with respect to xk. In particular, the motion was produced because v, x was changing in time, so there was a vk of x and t and rho of x and t. So this was the second major conclusion of the work from last time. The third major conclusion of the work from last time was that in the special case of Hamiltonian mechanics, you had what is called Liouville's theorem, which meant that the term in which the derivative applied on to v wasn't important because it canceled out, and one ended up with d rho of x and t dt plus the sum over k, the derivative with respect to all of the variables, rho of x and t equals zero. That was the third major conclusion of last time. That conclusion had to do also with a very interesting but hard to understand result in which the volumes in phase space, although as time went on, the shape of volumes in phase space changed very considerably, the size of volumes in phase space as produced by the motion of the system did not change. The volume that you began with was the same as the volume you ended up with. This was the fourth major conclusion of last time. Is that, do you guys want to ask questions about that? Yes, please. Thank you. Can't find the chalk. Get some more chalk. Excuse me. Make a real equation out of it.
I have a question.
Yes, please.
Yeah, so this, the random dynamical system with random variables, it's like we think we have one particle, right? Because xk is like one component in a vector, which points out the position of one particle in phase space.
So we look at, I'm not sure I understand the question, but we can understand this by thinking about one coordinate at a time, each coordinate changing. And so this xk, which is one coordinate, changes, and that makes rho change. The other coordinates change, that makes rho change. The entire change of rho with respect to time is because all the coordinates are changing. That's why we get a sum.
Yeah, but this we're thinking about one particle.
It doesn't matter. That is the most general dynamical system you ever heard of. Obeys the xk dt is vk of all the x's and t. You can have 10 to the 23rd coordinates, you could have 6 coordinates, you could have 1 coordinate. This relation is correct, whatever the dynamical system is.
Yeah, it's just when you say coordinates, I think about coordinates in phase space and
that you're quite welcome to do so.
Okay.
And one example is x being p and q for one particle. Another example is x is all the p's and all the q's for 10 to the 23rd particles. Another example is that you're thinking about one coordinate, because there's only one x that matters to you. Another example is that you think of the Lorentz model in which there are 3 coordinates. All those things, the mathematics applies. The great thing about mathematics is that if you do the logic correctly, you get a result which is independent of the details of what you're doing, that it is only dependent upon the assumptions you made at the beginning. And so this is a particular model. This is the result which is true for all dynamical systems, every dynamical system you ever heard of. This one is a specialization to Hamiltonian systems, and this is a specialization to Hamiltonian systems. I'm more than happy to help you all or help myself by struggling with any question you want to ask. So we did all that stuff. And we come to Liouville's theorem. Liouville's theorem talks about the conservation of volumes in phase space for Hamiltonian systems. This theorem is the statement that the volume elements in phase space are conserved in the course of a motion. That's a consequence of the term in which this derivative applies to that term canceling out. So if you start out with a probability function, rho of p and q for one particle, or maybe lots of particles, at time zero. And that function is non-zero in some region of phase space of volume omega of zero. After a time, rho of p, q, and t will progress to occupy a different region of phase space of volume omega of t. According to Liouville's theorem, as I said before, the volume of the regions before and after will be unchanged. That is, that omega of t is equal to omega of zero. Imagine, if you will, that the probability function was constant within the region you picked. That is, that rho of p and q of zero was 1 over omega zero in that region and zero elsewhere. Then by the same argument, every tiny volume of the subvolume of this original V region would also have its volume preserved under the transformation. And therefore, the value of rho of p and q and t within the new volume, within the new region, would be the same as the density within the old region. It would be 1 over omega of 0. Outside the new region, of course, this thing would vanish. Therefore, if you started out with constant volume in phase space, that is volume in phase space independent of P and Q, that property would be preserved forever. You can see that from the equation that you get from this relationship. And I'm going to write down the equation in great detail. If we have a rho which depends, or an f, f is just n times rho, this is a probability, f is a number of particles, which depends on p and q, or p and r, it doesn't matter whether we call the space coordinate r or q, and time t. And we have a Hamiltonian system. If we write down this equation, or rather this equation, what we have is two different effects. One in which we have the rho changing because P changes, and the other because rho changes because R changes. The term in R is gradient P of the Hamiltonian of P, R, and T, not gradient R. The term in P is the gradient R of the Hamiltonian in P, Q, and T, not gradient P. If this thing is then equal to zero, if rho is constant, then these derivatives are zero, and the time derivative of rho is zero. You start out with rho being constant, you end up with rho being constant. Here it is in an equation form. Here it is in an argument in words. I will use various symbols to describe what is going on. Instead of rho, I could have F. Since this is a linear equation, multiplying rho by the number of particles doesn't change anything. Instead of having a Hamiltonian here, I could think about having a representation of things in which I am thinking about an energy that applies to that particle, epsilon of P, R, and T. That's just the same thing with different symbols. This you think of as a Hamiltonian for the whole system. This you think of as an energy for the particle in question. The equation works with F instead of rho. The equation works if we're talking about the effect of the single particle energy instead of the Hamiltonian for the whole thing. Questions?
Well, using Liouville's theorem, can we claim that, well, closed ensembles in the phase space remain closed together during the time?
Let me come to, I'm going to get to ensembles maybe a slide from now or two slides from now. So let me get to it, and then you can ask your question again, okay? So here it is written out again with the Hamiltonian and P's and Q's. Here it is again saying that if we have rho being constant, it remains constant, but there is something else to be said. Let me imagine, I ate my chalk again. Let me imagine that rho is not constant, but is instead a function of the Hamiltonian. If rho is a function of the Hamiltonian, this guy in blue, which essentially is a Poisson bracket, looks like the following. The guy in blue starts out as being the derivative with respect to P of the Hamiltonian. Then we have the gradient in Q space of this rho, which depends on the Hamiltonian, H. We have a minus sign, the gradient in Q of the Hamiltonian dot the gradient in P of this rho that depends on H. We then use the chain rule for differentiation. That chain rule for differentiation gives this stuff, this sum over alpha, which I guess I haven't written out, so I'll write out the sum over alpha. Of the differential of H with respect to P, the differential of H with respect to Q, and then rho prime, the derivative of rho with respect to H, minus the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to Q, alpha, times the derivative of this, which is the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to P, alpha, times rho prime of H. So this whole collection of stuff up there in blue is just a fancy way of writing zero, because the two terms cancel out. That is the conclusion, number five in our conclusions, is that if rho is a function of the Hamiltonian, and nothing else, then d rho dt equals zero. Rho doesn't change in time. Rho remains just exactly that same function of the Hamiltonian for all time. Now, those of you who are worried about ensembles can understand what might be going on. One equilibrium solution. Is rho of P and Q and T is e to the minus beta H of P and Q divided by some partition function Z. That's one possible solution. This is the solution that Maxwell and Boltzmann thought about. Another equally good solution is rho is 1 over h squared plus a constant with some normalization to make it right. Or you could have 1 over h to the fifth power, or you could have perhaps the logarithm of h divided by some constant. Any function you want of h makes an equilibrium solution. Let me write it on this board since someone is craning his neck to see what's going on. Rho of h, any function, is an equilibrium solution. To this equation, which is an exact consequence of Hamiltonian mechanics. Different ensembles, I was asked about ensembles. Different ensembles are different functions of the Hamiltonian that are used. First, I should say why you don't use simply rho is equal to a constant. Almost all of phase space is out at momentum having huge, huge, huge values. That's not a physical region. So you need something, some way of keeping the momentum from getting huge, and the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution will do that. You get a very low probability of having a very high p, because this is minus beta times p squared. That's one way of doing it. There are other ways of doing it, and I'll talk to you in the next slide about the various ways people choose to do equilibrium solutions. However, you must recognize that something huge has happened here. We have talked about what Hamiltonian mechanics implies. We have understood what time-independent solutions are to classical mechanics. And we say that if we have rho being any function at all of the Hamiltonian, that provides a good time-independent solution. If there are other things that are conserved, like the momentum, or the angular momentum, or anything else that doesn't change in time, rho could be a function of those things as well. In particular, rho could be a function of the number of particles of a given time, if that number of particles did not change in time. According to what we have so far, any of these things will do. The usual way of doing things, most often done by statistical mechanics, is to use what is called the canonical ensemble. Canonical is a word which means usual. It is a derivation from a set of words used by the Catholic Church in which canonical law is the usual law of the church. Canonical ensemble means the ensemble we usually use. It has rho exponential minus h divided by kt divided by a partition function. However, well, this is the right thing to use for any large system. It is also the right thing to use if you have any small system. That's derivation. I'm now telling you the result of experience. The result of experience is that if you have any small system with other stuff around it, lots and lots and lots and lots of other stuff around it, and there is a weak exchange of energy between the small system and the large system, as there is in this model due to Einstein, then you should be using the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. That's the result of experience. On the other hand, that's not what people always do. Sometimes people use what is called the microcanonical ensemble, micro meaning small, in which the probability is chosen to be a delta function, in which the the Hamiltonian has some specific value, and then there's some normalization. This is for fixed number of particles. This is the right ensemble to use, of course, if the energy and the number of particles in your small system is fixed. This is okay to use if there are no other important variables beyond these things. However, if you have something like a conserved angular momentum, you may have to watch out for that, or you may have to watch out for a conserved momentum. For example, in the motion of galaxies, which are swirling around like that, the conserved angular momentum can be important, even though the energy might well be conserved. One more ensemble is generally used. It is called the Grand Canonical Ensemble and is an invention of Gibbs. This allows the number of particles to vary. Imagine that our small system was exchanging particles with its environment. Particles were leaking in and out. Then you would use an ensemble in which the number of particles would vary. You'd in fact want to have an exponential function controlling the number of particles. And you use this so-called grand canonical ensemble for situations in which the number of particles can vary. There's an extra factor of 1 over n factorial that appears in classical mechanical situations. The grand canonical ensemble is rho is e to the minus beta h minus mu, mu is called the chemical potential, n divided by n factorial in classical mechanics. You don't need this in quantum mechanics because if you have identical particles, there's essentially an n factorial built into the treatment by using the probability without this extra factor, and people have gotten confused arguing about this extra factor. The canonical and grand canonical ensembles are used a lot. They're particularly convenient. The microcanonical ensemble is particularly a pain in the neck. These are things that people use for actual everyday calculations. However, let me go back to the main point. The main point is that this equation is exactly true. It is exactly consistent with any function of the Hamiltonian, rho being any function at all of the Hamiltonian. The particular choice of Maxwell and Boltzmann is based on other arguments, like this argument of Einstein. Other arguments, bless me, beyond this exact equation. And I am about to tell you about some of these other arguments. We need some introduction of probabilistic concepts in order to get out the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. The Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution will only arise if we put in something that has probabilities in it, like this eta of t. And the derivation requires probabilities. However, for very large systems, that doesn't make much of a difference. Let me go back and talk about large systems for a moment. In large systems, any one of these ensembles will give you the same answer as any other one. That's because for a large system, the root mean square fluctuations in the energy are going to be small. The root mean square fluctuations are going to be proportional. The root means, blackboard. The RMS fluctuations in H are proportional to n to the 1/2. H itself is proportional to n, the number of particles in the system. Those root mean square fluctuations for a large system are so small that it doesn't matter whether you use the canonical ensemble with exactly with variable energy or the microcanonical ensemble with exactly fixed energy. Similarly, the number of particles may fluctuate, but it fluctuates if one puts in the right kind of ensemble so little that you don't have to worry about those fluctuations. So for large systems, it doesn't matter what ensemble one uses. However, when one talks about small systems, one has to be careful about the ensemble. And I now have to explain to you why the small system, the Maxwell-Boltzmann result is correct. I am telling you something which is harder than simple classical mechanics. Simple classical mechanics will not produce Maxwell and Boltzmann's results. This equation tells you exactly what it produces and produces something much more general as an equilibrium. What we need is an argument which goes beyond Maxwell and Boltzmann, and that argument is derived from this point of view, or we will derive it tomorrow, I think, from the equation called the Boltzmann equation, an equation originally derived by Boltzmann and describing the behavior of gases. I've said hard things here. If you want to ask questions about these hard things, it might be helpful. Yes?
Can you explain how microcanonical and just canonical sum can be equivalent?
Easily. I calculate I use the grand canonical ensemble and calculate. In the grand canonical ensemble, I calculate, for example, for independent particles, for weak interactions between particles, I calculate the mean square fluctuations in N. I find that these mean square fluctuations are proportional to N. In fact, it's equal to N for the simplest systems. That means that the average size of a fluctuation, the average fluctuation in N, which is the square root of this quantity, is equal to n to the 1/2. If n is 10 to the 23rd, n to the 1/2 is 10 to the 12th, and the fluctuation is of 1 part 10 to the 12th effect. Please do not worry about 1 part 10 to the 12th effects. Please use whatever ensemble you want to use.
But this explains why grand canonical ensemble and just canonical are similar. But why can we go to microcanonical?
Because, as you have, I think, calculated, the fluctuations in the energy, expectation value of H minus the expectation value of H squared, average, is an extensive quantity. That is, this thing is proportional to nkt squared in the simplest situation. This says that the fluctuation in the energy is proportional to kt times n to the 1/2. The energy itself is equal to nkt in the simplest situation. This is a factor of 10 to the 12th smaller than this. Again, please don't worry about things that are that small. They're not really important. That's why when one talks about thermodynamics, you talk about the energy of a system, even though if you thought about it carefully, you would realize that the energy was a fluctuating quantity. When I look at the pressure in my bicycle tire, I look at the pressure in that tire, 80 pounds per square inch or whatever. I don't talk about the fact that the pressure is produced by tons and tons of collisions of molecules with the rubber and the tire, and that it is a fluctuating quantity. The fluctuations do not matter in the larger systems. Thermodynamics is usual for large systems, is usually about things in which fluctuations are not important. Large systems are very large and tend to have fluctuations in intensive quantities, which are very small in relative magnitude. That's why you can get away with using any one of those ensembles. Okay. This is our work plan for the near future. What we have is we want to think once again about Brownian motion. We want to think once again about Einstein's little model. But now we are going to enrich Einstein's model. We're going to think about not only Einstein and the molecules hitting our given Brownian particle, we're going to add the equations, the things of classical mechanics to this in particular. We're going to look at a situation in which there is a single particle energy, epsilon of p, r, and c. This could be, might be p squared over 2m plus u of r. Maybe there are electromagnetic forces. Maybe p goes into p minus ea over c, u goes into u plus e times a scalar potential. Maybe this is a relativistic case. Maybe p squared over 2m isn't what you have. Maybe instead you have p squared plus m squared, c to the fourth. Maybe. Whatever it is, we have a single particle energy, epsilon of p, r, and t. And we have an equation for rho, which looks almost like this, but not quite. So I'm going to write down what we have and then go on from there. We have what's written there, d rho dt plus gradient p epsilon dot gradient r rho minus gradient r epsilon dot gradient p rho. That takes care of everything we might have in that single particle energy. We also have, plus, a term produced by this. We can understand that as the direct result of this thing, and that gives us a minus gradient p, p over tau, all applied to rho. That's the effect of this extra term. We already calculated the effect of things like this by using this argument. I just have to make sure I got the sign right. I think I've got the sign right. Equals dot, 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 dot. And that dot, 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 dot is the result of this term, which we haven't yet taken into account. We're going to take that into account. We're going to figure out what that term does. We're going to stick it into the equation, and then we're going to think about what this equation implies for the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. We will, of course, get the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution out when this is all done, because we know that we should get it out. However, the argument is interesting, and the argument is interesting in part because it absolutely requires this stochastic term in order to get the exponential dependence on the energy. Okay. You have, or you will have, the notes on this. However, the notes are less good, I think, than what I'm about to say. And so I'm going to take this thing into account by doing a calculation which is slightly different from what's in the notes. I want to think only about the effect of this, not about the effect of anything else. So I'm going to follow up on that and say that P of T plus delta T, some small time later, is changed by this, by the amount, the integral over times from t to t plus delta t of the random force eta of t. And I put vector symbols on this because these guys are random, and this is supposed to be integral over u, which stands, which is a dummy variable, which stands for time. Now I want to think about what happens to rho of p, r, and t because of this change. This is the change in p resulting from this extra force. I will call delta p equal to the integral du from t to t plus delta t eta of u. So the momentum has changed by that amount in this interval of time. You may ask, why don't I use this argument? Well, this argument is entirely linear, is linear in the velocities, and we know the linear effect of eta is zero, since we know that the expectation value of eta equals zero. However, we are going to get a second order effect from eta, an effect from eta squared, which will turn out to be linear in delta t. And that's going to be the important result. In fact, we know something about this. We know that this quantity at P, R, and t plus delta t, this is a time delta t later, that's produced because we have a rho of p minus delta p and r and t, and this is average. That is, that p changes from this value to this value. Because this delta p doesn't depend on p or upon r, I don't have to do any fancy arguments about how these derivatives work. The delta is independent of everything, of p and r, and I just have to look and expand this expression in delta p. So what we have is that as far as the effect of this delta P is concerned, we can use this, this expectation value means. Well, first of all, we have averaged over initial conditions. Someplace, maybe time zero, wherever that is, we have some initial conditions, and that's in the average, but that's also built into rho. We have an average.
Leo, are you saying that the rho is equal to the average? Like, which, where's the equal sign supposed to go?
Equal sign, right there.
Yeah, but is it equaling to the...
This guy is equal to that. Sorry, let me write it out. With, since you're not believing, I will write it out. P, R, T plus delta, T, equals. You don't believe, so I said it again. What happens is that the guy with momentum P minus delta P gains the extra momentum delta P, and becomes this guy. That's all that goes on. And naturally, the probability that we have P minus delta P produces this probability here. It is the most simple and direct effect imaginable. This equation is hard to fathom because it is so simple. Yes, please.
Why didn't you insert the fraction term in the first equation?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the words.
Why didn't you write the fraction term in the first equation here when you wanted to derive P of T plus delta T?
I understood a word fraction, but you probably said another word.
Yeah, maybe I'm right. I mean minus P over tau. Friction, sorry.
Okay. Friction.
Yeah.
Thank you. My ears are used to understanding New York speech, and Iran is a different place from New York. That term has already been included in my analysis because it's right here. I'm just doing dot, 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 which is this term. So I'm looking at the physical effects one by one. This physical effect is the effect that as the particle moves through space, that motion is produced by the velocity, gradient P epsilon, and that produces a term like that. This term moves the particle in momentum, and that's gradient P rho. This term is the friction term that you wanted to ask about, and we can calculate it by using this argument to get this result. And this is it. This is the velocity. This is then stuck in here. We have only left this random force which we have to calculate. And I'm doing the random force all by itself. So we're calculating the different physical effects one by one, and we claim that the effect of the delta P is that if I had a momentum delta P smaller at the earlier time, it produces a momentum P because the momentum changes by that much. That's all that's going on. And now I just have to explain to you what this average is. This is an average over all the initial conditions. It's an average over eta of u for u less than or equal to t. But both of these effects is completely in rho. It is also an average over eta of u for U between T and T plus delta T. That's in delta P, and that's what we have to take into account now. That's not included in this earlier row. It is directly in that delta P. And so we expand in that delta P. Delta P is small because I'm going to think about delta T as being small. And I'll expand to second order in delta P. That expansion gives me a 1/2 because, well, no, sorry. The first order term of that expansion is the gradient of P times rho, PRT, times the average of delta P with a minus sign. And I have an average. The next term is a 1/2 times delta P squared times the second derivative of rho with respect to P. And we average delta P squared. This average is 0 because the average of eta is 0. This is the average we have to calculate. These three lines are very simple. Four lines, if you want. They are very simple, but they are at the heart of a rather sophisticated calculation. We are doing stochastic differential equations, and we are then trying to understand what the effect is of this stochastic random variable, this random variable, upon the probability distribution. And we needed this argument and this argument to get there. Now, we calculated delta P squared last time, but I will calculate it for you again this time. Again, I ate the chalk. Because the average of eta of u is equal to 0, this term doesn't exist.
Sir? First question. I don't understand, like you said, average over eta u, u smaller or equal to t, average over eta u, t, u between t and t plus delta t, like?
Eta is a function of time.
And it just,
all of the earlier behavior of eta is hidden in this row. It is only the behavior between t and delta t plus delta t that we have to take into account now.
Okay. But why did you write u smaller than t? Like it's...
I'm sorry, I didn't understand your words. Let me tell you what we're going to do, and then maybe it'll be clear, and maybe you want to ask the question again. Delta P squared average is the average of the integral from T to T plus delta T of du dv times the average of eta of u times eta of v. You've seen that integral before, but that's what delta P squared is, an average. So all I'm doing is worrying about the change that we get from here. U is a dummy variable. I can call it U or V or Rumpelstiltskin if I wanted to. These are two integrals that we have to calculate. And this is just going to turn out to be a delta function of U minus V. This is gamma times the delta function of U minus V. And this then, it turns out to be, because of this delta function, the whole thing turns out to be gamma delta t, which is what it was last lecture, and it's equally so in this lecture. Mm-hmm. And now we're in business. I forgot to include the zeroth order term. I included the first order term in delta p, but there's also a zeroth order term, which is rho of p, r, and t, average, but there's nothing to average there.
I think I know what he meant. When you have on the right-hand side of the block, of the board, where you have your writing, and it says average over eta u, and then you have u less or equal than t. Okay, good. So, no, a line above.
Okay. Imagine that we set out to calculate the effect of eta on everything over all earlier times. That's what we mean by rho. Rho is the effect of eta for all earlier times. I'm sorry, I lost whom I was answering. Please stick up your hand so I can see who I'm talking to. Okay, great. This rho of PRT includes all the effects of eta of u for zero, that's maybe is our initial point, less than u, less than t. That's what rho is supposed to be about. And we're only calculating the extra stuff that we get from delta p. So the change in rho in the time delta t is produced by the extra stuff that we get from that delta p, and that extra stuff in this calculation is supposed to be proportional to gamma times delta t. A linear change in rho in the time delta t is produced by this gamma delta t effect and 1/2, which comes from a second order expansion and gradient p squared. So on the right-hand side of this equation, from this we see that rho of p, r, and t plus delta t, that's this, minus rho of p, r, and t, that's this, that's the zeroth order term in this expansion, is equal to the result of the second order term of the expansion, 1/2 gamma times the gradient p squared of rho of p, r, and t. Rho changes because the random force jiggles it. The jiggling produces gradients in p, but only do you see a second order effect. The average first order effect of the jiggling vanishes. It then follows that, just taking that delta t, that delta t, it then follows that d rho dt from this effect is equal to times delta t is equal to 1/2 gamma gradient p squared rho times delta t, or that d rho dt from this effect is 1/2 gamma gradient p squared rho, or that I, instead of dot dot dot, I put in 1/2 gamma times gradient p squared rho. This is the effect of the jiggling on rho. Now we can go back to the slides. Give a little bit of luck. Yep, there we go. Okay, on this slide is the calculation I just did. The top says that the change in rho over the time delta t is produced because we have a change in p over that time. That change in p is then given by the integral du over eta of u between t and t plus delta t. The average, as I already said, includes all of the stuff in eta between those two times. Here I call the dummy variable of integration s instead of u. Now I expand in delta t. On the left-hand side, we have delta t times the prime derivative. On the right-hand side, we have an expansion in delta p. And when you calculate the result, you get this term, as the time derivative of rho is gamma over 2 times the second derivative with respect to p of rho of p and t. And that's what I just stuck in here. This is a diffusion in momentum space. Because it's a diffusion, it can't be followed backward in time. Notice we had to go to the second order of our calculation in order to get anything, because the second order effect in delta p is, in fact, first order in delta t. That's what makes this into a hard calculation. In fact, it is a hard calculation. But now we have an equation, a partial differential equation, which we can solve. Now we have reduced our problem to something which doesn't involve any more stochastic calculus or other hard things. It just involves solving a partial differential equation. It's sort of all on this slide or all on the board. If you want to ask about it, you're quite welcome to do so. It's also all up on the notes. Now, I had written this term in two different ways. The less general form of this term is written here. It can be said to be proportional to the momentum divided by tau. That makes the assumption that epsilon p is p squared over 2m. So that the velocity is going to be proportional to p. However, we could just as well write this as really the velocity times some constant. And we could just as well write this then putting in. Okay, I will rewrite the equation as rho dt plus gradient p epsilon gradient r rho minus gradient r epsilon gradient p rho is equal to, on the right-hand side, what we just calculated, 1/2 gamma gradient p squared rho. And then I will carry over from this the gradient p some constant times epsilon, epsilon being the single particle energy, gradient p with respect to epsilon, giving us this velocity and some term which is equivalent to this times rho. So I just replaced this p over tau by something more general, which was the velocity determined as the gradient p of epsilon. The reason for doing this is that I want the most general possible derivation of the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. I don't want the p squared over 2m in the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. I want an epsilon which could be relativistic, which could include gravitational effects, could include electromagnetic effects. And now this is what the equation looks like. On the right-hand side, we have the effect of Einstein's terms. On the left-hand side, we have the effect of Hamiltonian mechanics. And now we want to see how we can make the equation reach an equilibrium solution. This equation of this form, is called the Fokker-Planck equation. It is equivalent to Einstein's argument about how equilibrium is reached in a Brownian system. However, it is more general. More general because it has these epsilons, more general because it has the general time dependence of a Hamiltonian system. More general because it looks like and is close to what Boltzmann does for the Boltzmann equation. I want to see what will happen to make this term vanish. To make this term vanish, I'm going to guess that I should have rho being equal to e to the minus q times some constant. The constant will turn out to be 1 over z, or rather, I guess what I did in the notes was put the constant up here. The constant will then be equal to the logarithm of 1 over z. And this q will be a function of p, r, and t. When we take this gradient arm to rho, we then get an expression in which we're taking the derivative of q. There's one more gradient left over here. And then we have the derivative with respect to p of epsilon. This is now the direct effect of that equation up there. And now we see that if we take q being proportional to epsilon, we get this, these Einstein terms canceling out of the equation. This term cancels against that. We're left with this stuff, which is going to cancel no matter what if we have q being proportional to epsilon, because this is the Poisson bracket expression, which vanishes whenever rho is any function of epsilon. The net result is that we get a solution of the equation in which d rho dt changes not at all in time if rho is proportional to e to the minus epsilon times something. And that's something we can jiggle the value of this constant c and of gamma so that that something is 1 over kt. It is not enough to have the effects of velocity, that's what this effect is, and force, that's what this effect is, cancel out in the equation for d rho dt. We have to have some stochastic effect in order to force the solution to be of the Maxwell-Boltzmann form. Well, that's reasonable. It's what necessarily happens. Any isolated system can have rho being any function of the energy, any function at all. To make it a particular function that Maxwell and Boltzmann talked about, we need to have the effects that Einstein talked about, the effects of the jiggling by the molecular collisions, the effects of that slowing down by friction. This is what is required in order to get the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, and this derivation gives you what is required. Now, you might regard it as a surprise. In fact, it is a surprise that we need to have the something beyond Hamiltonian, simple Hamiltonian mechanics in order to get the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. But the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution is in effect a frictional effect. It is in fact a frictional effect, and we include friction in calculating it. So here it is on the slide. Time derivative of rho plus the terms produced by the Liouville equation, the gradient of P of epsilon, gradient R rho minus the gradient R epsilon, gradient P rho, is equal to the stuff that came from the Einstein calculation, or rather from the Fokker and Planck version of the Einstein calculation. If we imagine having lots of Brownian particles, say n of them, we can talk about the distribution function that talks about how many we have with that, and we get an equation for F, which is just of the same form. It's quite general. If we have Newtonian gravity in here, we have electrodynamics, it still works. It still gives us the right equilibrium and gives us the right relaxation for a particle in a Brownian system. This is a correct description of the dynamics of a particle in a Brownian system. This is also extremely hard. The new mathematics in it, there is new mathematics for you at several places. There is the general dynamical systems theory, which you haven't seen, and which the important thing is this dilation term. There is the effect of the stochastic random variable, which you haven't seen before and appears in the second derivative with respect to P term. There is then a solution of what is in effect a nonlinear partial differential equation, which I wrote down for you, but it's not trivial to do. If all of this stuff is hard mathematics, it is indeed hard mathematics. If you think all of the interesting math got invented in the 21st century, that's just not so. This was a calculation carried out by scientists in the first 20 years of the 20th century and is a beautiful calculation describing a real physical effect in terms of an equation which is quite generally valid. Now, I'm going to take a deep breath, and I'm going to go on to talk about Boltzmann's argument, but Boltzmann's argument is different. In many ways, it is simpler than the arguments I've given here. It has many ways it's simpler. Let me tell you what Boltzmann was talking about, or field any questions you have about the work up until now. This exists in the notes. The notes are only a little different from what I did in class, and I'd be happy to answer questions when you look at the notes and decide what's hard. What Boltzmann did, so I'm going on to the next topic, since you guys haven't formulated a question, yes, you formulated.
I'm wondering about this. I mean, where does this stochastic behavior come from? Does it, I mean, is it because we have lots of particles and we don't have complete information that we insert a stochastic variable, or is there something, do we say it's stochastic? Or?
If you have only Hamiltonian mechanics, exactly Hamiltonian mechanics, that is exactly this, and not this, then you have full-time reversal invariance.
Yeah.
You can't relax to anything. In order to have relaxation to equilibrium, you have to have some additional physics. That additional physics is this friction term, this random jiggling. Friction is just another way of talking about the effects of random jiggling. This is random jiggling pushing you, giving you more momentum, and this is the random jiggling slowing you down. Without jiggles, time reversal invariance. With time reversal invariance, no equilibrium.
Yeah, but these jiggles that push you forward, where do they come? Because I can see that you lose energy, but where do you gain energy from, right, physically?
Okay, let me, you look. Okay, there you are. The football match has just ended. It doesn't matter which kind of football, either kind of football. You're on the field, and there are people running around in all directions. Crazy people doing crazy things, and they keep bumping into you. Those crazy people are jiggling you, and you get bump. That's what happens.
So it's like the effects of some kind of environment that we're.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And we need to include not necessarily the environment, but something which has, look, yes, we need to include the environment. We need to include some averaging process, averaging over things that happen in the environment. After the football game, you say not that you were pushed 2 inches that way, 3 feet that way. You say that you were bounced around a lot. Here, too, you say that the Brownian particle is bounced around a lot. That's what gives it its momentum, and that's what makes it have a distribution function, which is e to the minus p squared over 2m divided by kt. The physics is exactly the physics that you would get if you were standing out on the football field. Yes.
About what he asked before, the particles gaining and losing energy, is because the Maxwell Boltzmann distribution is in the canonical ensemble. Could we think that this is because the particle is in a thermal bath and it's taking and losing energy with the thermal bath?
That's exactly right. The particle is in a thermal bath. It, again, like the football field, this happens, that happens, this happens, and you're moving around all directions. That's what the thermal bath is about. And without the thermal bath, there is no equilibrium. Boltzmann himself, I'll answer any questions you want, but I also will tell you where we're going. Boltzmann himself looked at a particle. The particle's a round thing in a gas. No, I'm sorry, the particle is not the round thing. The particle is this guy called P and Q. Boltzmann looked at a particle with momentum P in a gas. And he said it keeps bumping into particles with momentum Q, and producing output, which is another, the same particles with momentum p prime and q prime. This bumping in process is particles. It's like this. There's also the opposite process, which is on the next slide. And I'm feeling a little confused, but let me. So we have, this is just the same thing written over again. There's also the opposite process. Two particles, one with momentum p prime, one with momentum q prime, come in, bump into one another, and produce our friend with momentum p, also a particle with momentum q. These environmental effects are going to affect the distribution of particles with momentum p, that effect and this effect. We have to take them into account in order to get the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution for the particles with momentum p. That's what the calculation of Boltzmann was all about. He calculates the effect of these collisions. Now, this is a better calculation in some ways than Einstein did. All kinds of stuff is hidden in here. This is very explicit about what collisions go on. However, it's also a much harder calculation. This calculation is linear in the unknown rho. This calculation says that you have an F describing the particle with momentum P, and an F describing the particle with momentum Q, telling you how many you have of them. And that calculation then tells you how often the scatterings occur. And by calculating the effect of the scatterings, and making that scattering balance off against that scattering, we will get equilibrium. But you need to calculate in full detail the results of these scatterings. So next time, we will go on and calculate the results of these scatterings and get the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution out of these scatterings and a lot more. The calculation that Einstein gave us doesn't tell us anything about entropy. This Boltzmann calculation will directly give us a formula for entropy and tell us how entropy increases. You all, I think, have some worries about what I have said today. I advise you to look at the notes, figure out where your worries are, and try to ask questions about it. I will then pick up on this calculation of the Boltzmann equation and pick up on this second derivation of the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution.